You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Well, I'm very excited to turn to my next guest. He's a Canadian MP, and I think it's well overdue that actually we turned our focus to Canada. I've obviously talked to people from everywhere, from Taiwan to the US, the UK and beyond, but this will be my first guest from Canada. So I'm very pleased to introduce to you a Member of Parliament, Kevin Vong. Welcome along, Kevin.
Thanks for having me, Simon.
Hey, it'll be better to start with the basics. Is obviously, you're Canadian. We're on radio, but I need to tell people you're a very young Member of Parliament. But tell us a bit about yourself and even where you're, well, you would call it a riding. We think of it as an electorate. Just tell us a bit about yourself and where you're representing at the moment.
Sure. So my electorate is known as Spadina Fort York. I have the privilege of representing the best electorate in Canada. This is a downtown Toronto, what we call riding. We are home to everything from Canada's Wall Street, what we call Bay Street. We are also home to the Toronto Stock Exchange, some of Canada's largest, whether it's mining companies, pension funds, financial institutions, but also tech. Things that I think perhaps people are more culturally aware of. I'm also the Member of Parliament for the CN Tower, which is a key part of Toronto's skyline. If you're a big fan of the Toronto Raptors, which was a 2019, we call it, since the NBA is America, they call it World Champions. In 2019, Toronto Raptors, the Toronto Blue Jays, or if hockey is your fancy, also home to the Toronto Maple Leafs. And so I have the privilege of representing over 130,000 people in just 12 square kilometers. It is one of the most dense communities in the country. And so we also have an island airport. It's quite diverse. It's very fun place to be. We have neighborhoods that have been named by Vogue as the second coolest neighborhood in the world. And so it is an incredible place to live, to study, and to work.
Well, I have to say, it's pretty much one of only two cities in Canada that I've visited. I've stayed in Toronto, I've been up the tower, had a good look around. I know about the Blue Jays because of friends there. And the other place I went to was up in Ottawa, minus 40 degrees, freezing cold. But Toronto, as you say, amazing, amazing city. You've been an MP for, what, about 3 or so years now? You were elected last election, is that right?
That's right. So in 2021, I was elected. I was the youngest Member of Parliament of Asian heritage. I'm also the only Member of Parliament of Vietnamese heritage. My parents were actually Vietnamese boat people. They were part of the Chinese diaspora that were persecuted by communists following the Vietnam War. And so they spent 2 years in a refugee camp in Thailand before they were welcomed to Canada. And they were welcomed at a time, Simon, when other countries were closing their borders to people in need. And they made sure that I knew that, how lucky I was to be born and raised in Canada. And what came with that also was a responsibility to give back. And frankly, it was probably my primary motivation for why I volunteered to join the Naval Reserve in Canada. I'm proud to have served in His Majesty's Royal Canadian Navy now for 9.5 years. And it's a perspective that I think has been important to bring to the House of Commons in Canada. And I was a former, or I guess still technically an entrepreneur, or small business owner. I know what it's like to worry about paying next month's rent. I know what it's like in terms of having the pressures of making payroll. And those are all perspectives that I worked hard to be able to bring to the House of Commons and advocate for small business owners, for Canadians. And unfortunately, there are far too many who are struggling to make ends meet.
Without getting too much into New Zealand politics, so there's, you know, we talked about the small to medium businesses, massive, massive struggles here, always has been, but certainly post-COVID times and the way things were managed here, it's just got so, so difficult. But you bring quite a remarkable heritage. So were your parents living in Vietnam, but because of their Chinese heritage, were pushed out post the war, as you say, by the communists?
Mm-hmm. That's correct. They made sure that I knew the dangers of a radical ideology. And I think that's, for me, one of the reasons why I've been so outspoken on a few files, including the issue of foreign interference. Unfortunately, Canada has been a target of a number of different actors. Principally, this is Russia, who is looking really to Canada as not only a target for hybrid warfare, but predominantly as a conduit to the United States. India, which is very worried about the Khalistani separatist elements within the Sikh diaspora, and India views Khalistanis as a terrorist group. And they unfortunately do have a base in Canada. And then the latter two are the Chinese Communist Party, who see Canada both as a means to US, but also ends in itself. So, I mean, we have a significant Chinese diaspora, and as well as different diaspora communities from the Uyghur community, Tibetans, Taiwanese. I mean, they make up three of the five poisons, if you will, that China views as some of their key strategic objectives. The other two are obviously just the matter of democracy writ large, which they are not a fan of, and Falun Gong. And so I have the distinction, Simon, of probably having pissed off the Chinese Communist Party on all five poisons, albeit to varying degrees.
All five? You've been sort of keeping a bingo card.
Well, I after you do a few at that point, why not just go for all five? And then the final actor in Canada is the Islamic regime in Iran. And so they have been very active, and it's more and more we're learning about how they're also coordinating with others in terms of being oppressing their various diasporas, whether it's the peace and freedom loving Iranian Canadian community or working with the Chinese to ultimately attack our democracy and weaken trust in our institutions.
Well, I think it's this area of foreign interference that we, I think one of the most important things that we want to talk about, and in particular around the CCP, but really, really quickly, particularly with Iran to start with. I think in recent weeks, your parliament or the government has finally designated the Iranian Guard Corps, sorry, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, a terrorist organization. Is that right?
That's right. We fought for that for years, and the Iranian diaspora has been demanding this for even longer. And so it took, I mean, there were two votes in multiple, in two different parliaments, unanimous, I might add, that called for the government to do this. The Liberals under Justin Trudeau refused to do so. And in fact, in 2015, when they defeated the Conservative government and first came into power, one of their platform promises was actually to reestablish relations with Iran, something that the Conservative government had ended. And so they've always had perhaps danced a little bit too closely with the Islamic regime in Iran. But fortunately, we were finally able to stop the IRGC from not just operating, but fundraising on Canadian soil, from continuing to oppress and intimidate. And there have been instances where Iranian Canadians have nearly been run over. Others who have been targets of acts of violence and intimidation because they've been too outspoken about the atrocities that continue to be perpetuated even now by the Islamic regime, not only on their own people, but around the world.
You guys are to be congratulated, which is why I raised it. It's something that New Zealand has not done, and New Zealand seems to be exceptionally reluctant, I'm afraid to say, Kevin, of designating regimes as terrorists. I mean, it's only in recent times that Hamas and Hezbollah, for example, we still have not, sadly, designated the Islamic Republican Guard Corps, IRGC, despite, wow, actually, very similar. I suppose it's one of the reasons we're chatting amongst others is that there's a lot of similarities between Canada and New Zealand. And we have a very small but active group of Iranian New Zealanders. I've been particularly involved with them around the Woman Life Freedom movement. Mm-hmm. And it's just horrid what continues to happen. Though one thing we haven't had, and I hope I got this right, but you had this is the India side. There was a bit of an incident in the last few months, or was it last year, where was it an attempted or a successful assassination of a Sikh nationalist that was linked back to the Indian government? I hope that's not too sensitive to ask about.
No, I mean, it's all public. So last year, there was a Canadian, Mr. Najjar, who was murdered. Now, what is not clear, the investigation is ongoing, is whether or not this was an act, an extrajudicial killing, which obviously is alarming, or if it was a murder by internally. The reality is there is, when it comes to the Khalistani separatist movement, and for your listeners, Simon, these are people who believe the province of Punjab in India should separate and become its own country under Khalistani rule. You know, Indians view them as terrorists. And the individual who was killed was viewed by India as a terrorist. And my understanding is they were also on Interpol's list as well. Now, what the Prime Minister did following this Mr. Najjar's murder was, I think, unprecedented. Instead of leaving it to the authorities, who I think would have been a more appropriate place to be able to disclose any information they may have had, the Prime Minister instead saw it as occasion at a time when he was facing a lot of heat in the House of Commons around the government's inaction with regards to the Chinese foreign interference. I guess he wanted to change the channel because he stepped on the floor of the House of Commons and he accused India, a democratic ally, of assassinating a Canadian citizen. And Simon, you know, I don't think you need to be an expert in foreign affairs to realize that is not a good idea. I don't think the President of the United States would step onto the floor of Congress and do the same. Instead, he would leave it to the FBI, and that's what they did, right? In terms of being the ones who are in charge of the investigation, ultimately the ones best placed to be able to reveal any information if they can, with regards to, in the United States case, a failed attempt, right? And so in Canada, instead, we had the Prime Minister make this accusation, and then when questioned about it, then said, well, actually, we have credible evidence, but I can't tell you what it is. And so it made a mockery of due process. It made a mockery of our justice system. But then it also then now has immensely hurt Canada's Indo-Pacific strategy. Because you, Simon, you don't have much of an Indo-Pacific strategy if you don't have the Indo.
Exactly, exactly right. And then speaking, of course, of the Indo-Pacific, probably the biggest element of foreign affairs, or one that's certainly talked about a lot, is China, or let's be specific, communist China. And I know that's something that we've briefly talked about off air, but you've had personal and direct experience of their interference into your own lives. So, I mean, would you mind sharing a bit of that for listeners? Because we have instances and incidents of it here in New Zealand, myself included, which listeners will know about. But I think it's important that they hear firsthand from you, of someone who has been targeted by the CCP in your own country.
Certainly. And I share these because I want people to know the dangers of leaving foreign interference unaddressed. And they can have very real consequences. It may start perhaps with elected officials, formerly like yourself, Simon, and me, but if they can do it to us, they can do it to anyone. And so, you know, some of the instances that I face has been bomb threats. I don't think it is a coincidence that when I started speaking out very strongly against the issue of foreign interference, particularly from the Chinese Communist Party, that's when we received our first bomb threat, which, to put it lightly, was a little disconcerting. And in total, we've received five. But there, even before five different separate instances of foreign interference. I mean, I have been targeted at my home. My wife has been stalked and followed, and then both her and I were subsequently followed as well too, in an act to try to send us a message. One, that they know where we live. Two, that they can get to us. And they had followed my wife, just for, I guess, a little bit more context, on a Sunday night. She's five and at the time, she's 5.5 months pregnant. It's good to stay active. It's to make the pregnancy easier, particularly delivery. And so she went out on a summer evening stroll, as any normal person would want to be able to do. And she took the circuitous path because she's just enjoying the Sunday evening. And the very next morning on the Monday, my wife and I thought, hey, we'd start the week with a walk, get a little activity in before we're at our desk. And what do we see? There are posters targeting me with disinformation, one of which included, you know, that I allegedly am a genocide supporter, all along the path that my wife had taken, right? It was an indirect, she was just, you know, kind of wandered all around different places. And so my wife and I were like, all right, well, we got to take this garbage down. And when we were making our way back, still taking down posters, I didn't notice it, but my wife saw that someone had pulled aside in their Mercedes SUV and got out and was taking photos of us. And she very quickly, on her feet, was like, all right, well, I got to take a picture of this. So she snapped a photo of the woman who did that, as well as their license plate and the vehicle. And we decided very quickly, because they confronted us. And my wife just played along. They're like, why are you taking my photo? Well, it's like, well, someone, you were taking a photo of us. And someone's been clearly targeting my husband with this disinformation. And the individual that had confronted us said, oh, well, did you think I was stole this car or something? And anyway, so drove away. We're like, well, this is probably very alarming. They're actively following us. So we rushed home, and we first call I made was to Sergeant Arms at the House of Commons in Canada, who subsequently spoke with our Mounties, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, our federal police. And then I called local police, who dispatched two officers right away. And when they took our statement, what was alarming to me, Simon, is, and I think it's one of the recommendations that I have for New Zealanders, is that local police, unfortunately, do not have the expertise necessarily, nor the resources to be able to tackle the issue of foreign interference. Because one of the things that they did following taking my statement was to go and interview, because we had the license plate, that woman and actually her husband who owned the vehicle. And they obviously lied about her story. Apparently they said she thought we were lost and were concerned for us. Well, she never one, we were holding our phones. Two, she never asked if we were lost. But the reality is, when it comes to these foreign operatives, they know the threshold of criminality. So they know that they simply just need to get close enough, but not cross over. And if they don't cross into criminality, there is nothing that law enforcement can do. And I bring this up because up until this, this happened about 2 months ago, up until this incident, Simon, I would have said Canada's criminal code has existing laws that we can apply, right? Coercion, intimidation, criminal harassment, those are all there. But what I realized, and this is what we passed before the summer recess, is that there's a need to specifically add criminal offenses from a foreign interference lens. Because if you leave it up to interpretation, particularly by local police officers who don't have the expertise, then it's unfortunately subject to interpretation. And so my recommendation for New Zealand is to specifically look at adding into your criminal code offenses that can then equip your law enforcement and security services to look at things from a foreign interference lens.
Oh, look, 100%. And particularly for listeners to understand that the example that Kevin's just used echoes some, I want to stress, some of my experience. I haven't had the leafleting per se, but that dynamic of being followed, then putting up posters, being photographed, making sure you know that they are following you is a classic CCP ploy. I've certainly been used to the photography side of where you appear, and they want to make sure that you know that they're both following and photographing you. But it's all part of that psychological warfare. But the other part that you noted, Kevin, around the recommendations, look, 100 percent right. I can't mention the operative's name, but he's someone I'm very aware of, as are our intelligence services. But the observation about what he was doing, which was basically he would attend, in this case, New Zealand Chinese events and leaflet cars, or just happen to talk to people, turn up to their homes, et cetera, et cetera. So a CCP thug, for want of a better word. Mm-hmm. But when our intelligence services met him, shall we say, he was able to explain the New Zealand law as well as they could. Put another way, he knew our laws so well that he knew exactly how far he could go. And ultimately, he was doing nothing illegal. So your recommendation there is absolutely correct, something I've been calling for years, unsuccessfully, I might add. So for you, obviously, and your wife, I mean, very distressing, as I say, part of that psychological intimidation. But is part of it, obviously, your outspokenness as a member of parliament, but is it also, too, that you do come from Chinese heritage, amongst others, in that you're a greater threat to them because they don't like dissent, or the CCP does not like dissent from within their own community?
That's right. It's been described to me by experts in the field that I am kind of like their worst case scenario. They absolutely hate people like me who are a member of the community, who actually speak the language. I speak Cantonese. My Mandarin's not the greatest, but you know, it's a good accent. I've had people who come to me and after I introduce myself in Mandarin, who just start busting out their Mandarin thinking I can respond. And that's where I'm like, you know, please speak slower. But on a more serious note, I'm a member of the Chinese diaspora. I don't have any relatives in China that they can intimidate. I know the dangers of a radical ideology like communism. And I am someone who has demonstrated that I have both a strong support for democracy. I've been vocal about Taiwan. I've been vocal about the, if we think about the five poisons that the Chinese Communist Party absolutely despise, the issue of Tibet, the issue of democracy, and particularly how they've dismantled Hong Kong's democratic institutions. And finally, the Uyghur genocide that is being committed, a very real and actual genocide that the Chinese Communist Party is doing to the Uyghur Muslims. And so they do not like people like me who are uncompromising, who are hard to intimidate, who actually come from the community.
Well, they've tried to attack your credibility, haven't they? They've basically thrown as much mud at you as possible.
I'll provide context for your listeners, Simon. So in 2021, I was asked by the Liberals, who are the governing party, to run. And I thought I was about to live the Canadian dream, if I'm to be honest. I mean, in one generation, my family would have gone from refugees to having one of their children serve and give back to the very country that gave our family everything. And it was all going well and good until 4 days before the general election, magically, a false allegation against me. Years ago, I was falsely accused of sexual assault. It was completely bogus, and ultimately it was withdrawn by the Crown without any conditions. But 4 days before the election, it just resurfaced, coincidentally. And the reality is, you and I both know, politics is a blood sport. Political parties sling mud all the time. Political parties would 100% do stuff like this, and has absolutely done stuff like this before. However, they know better. They know that if you truly want to destroy my campaign and my ability to stand in the general, you would do it 2 weeks before the general election, before the mail-in ballots, before any advance voting, and give enough time for Elections Canada to change the ballots and reprint them. Who would make such an amateur mistake as to drag my name through the mud only 4 days before? Well, perhaps a bad actor that doesn't operate democratic system and wouldn't know the nuances. Now, ultimately, whoever it was successful in dragging my name through the mud. And I can tell you, as a rookie to politics, who would never, you know, I wasn't a partisan. I was not a member of the party until I was asked to run. It was a rough start, and it's taken some time to be able to kind of claw back. But at the end of the day, the truth always comes out, and people are now realizing that of, you know, by looking at what happened to me as a very serious and perhaps a very public consequence of what happens when we leave foreign interference unaddressed.
My own experience has not been anywhere near that dramatic or emotional, but I was one of three public figures, two MPs and an academic, who were targeted by email cyber attacks effectively. And part of it was trying to send a signal to many other people. It's what you actually mentioned right at the start. If they can get to people like you and me, then they can get to many, many others. And one of the other things we've had here, Kevin, is the use of the likes of WeChat to spread some pretty terrible rumors about different people, journalists and others. It's a very effective tool, I'm sad to say, from the CCP. So obviously you've had a god-awful ride. But you're one of several MPs. I know there's another one. I've not met him, but Michael Chong, I think he moved. Yeah, he moved. He's been quite outspoken along with others such as yourself around the Uyghurs, but he came under some targeting as well. Are you able to expand, obviously, beyond yourself then of some of the other things that you're seeing in Canada?
Absolutely. And actually, but just because you bring up WeChat, let me give you an example of another former parliamentarian before I share what happened to Michael.
Oh, please.
Kenny Chu, C-H-I-U, is a former Conservative member of parliament who was unsuccessful in 2021. And he was targeted because he brought forward a private member's bill to create a foreign agent registry. And this is actually ties into the second recommendation that I would give to New Zealanders. The reality is these bad actors, these foreign operatives, they hide in the shadows. And the best way to attack that is sunlight. Sunlight is the best disinfectant. And so to add transparency, the creation of foreign agent registry for anyone who is lobbying or advocating on behalf of a foreign entity, a foreign nation, or a state-owned enterprise, those who are legally doing that will be, sure, it's a little bit extra administrative work, but that's not the issue. But by doing so, you provide a mechanism for your law enforcement to directly confront those who are doing so deceptively or clandestinely and ultimately illegally. Now, Kenny Chu, because he brought that forward, because this is in spite of him also being of Chinese heritage, just like myself, there was a lot of disinformation shared by the Chinese Communist Party on WeChat that swung the vote of Chinese Canadians in the electorate that he represented to his liberal opponent, who ultimately won. And so that is, unfortunately, a Canadian parallel example to what you and others have faced here in New Zealand.
Now, Michael, it's just terrible. I mean, look, a very quick anecdote, because some listeners won't have heard it, but before the last election, New Zealand Chinese man pulled out a knife at a protest by Falun Gong practitioners in an area called Mission Bay. So it's in my riding or electorate. Long and short, they were standing peacefully, pulled out a knife, slashed their sign, and had one of his mates film it. And he posted it. I eventually got hold of it, called him a thug, demanded police do something. But long and short, he and his supporters then, because I don't speak a word of Mandarin or Cantonese, I must admit, nor am on WeChat, but they went crazy on WeChat, absolutely slamming me, which is their free democratic right. Just that, if you will, malicious statements, which unfortunately, and here's my quick swing at mainstream media, decided to run with it as well, saying that I had clearly upset the Chinese community. And this was just a few days before voting started. It was like, well, I haven't really upset the Chinese community per se. I was calling out a thug pulling out knives in public, which they only admitted in the article at the end. But again, I don't know, collusion, for want of a better word, but it can be exceptionally well, as you know, exceptionally damaging. Anyway, I've interrupted you. I'm the one interviewing you, not me to be doing all the talking.
No problem, Simon. But I think it's important to share these experiences because it shows, one, that these incidents are not isolated, that this is an issue that crosses boundaries and borders. And it's important that we stand together, united, because China on its own is too big for any one country to be able to take. And it's why it's important that there are these, you know, things like the Interparliamentary Alliance on China. I know I'm going off script a little bit, but I'm grateful we're speaking because you're bringing an important perspective, Simon, as a former co-chair for New Zealand of IPAC.
Yeah, and it's why IPAC exists, actually, is for people like you and I and actually a network across the world to compare notes and show to our, I don't know, respective jurisdictions that this is happening all across the world consistently, because what you're sharing echoes what I've seen and heard here and vice versa. And I suppose a lot of what we've been doing, and I know you've been here in New Zealand speaking to various groups, just alerting people to say this is not a rare occurrence. It's happening all the time and across the world. So yeah, talk us through the Michael Chong and then some of the wider things. I know you had the CCP police stations as well, which we've had. Mm-hmm. So yeah, just talk us through that.
Sure. Okay. All right. So Michael Chong is a longstanding MP, frankly, someone who I look up to quite a bit and hope to, you know, I want to be like Michael Chong one day. And he is has sponsored a number of key motions, including one in the previous parliament, so not the one that I served, but in the 43rd parliament, that labeled Beijing, rightfully so, for what they're doing in the Xinjiang province as a genocide against Uyghur Muslims. And so when he did that in early 2021, before the general election, I believe it was January of 2021, that put him as a priority target for the Chinese Communist Party. And so there was this is radio, so you can't see me doing this, but air quotes of a diplomat in the Toronto Chinese consulate, individual by the name of Zhao Wei, who then started plotting to target not only Michael Chong in Canada, but relatives of his in Hong Kong. Now, this was alarming, obviously, but what was concerning is our security service, spy service, known as CSIS in Canada, caught wind of this and was aware of this plot in 2021. But unfortunately, Michael Chong nor his family knew about it. And Michael, found out in 2023, 2 years later, when the rest of us found out, because there were loyal Canadians in our security service who could not stay quiet anymore, who could not continue to do nothing, and leaked this information, this intelligence, to one of Canada's national papers. And so ultimately, through a lot of public shaming, we were able to force the government to declare Zhao Wei. This is the diplomat, really the spy who was organizing the plot against Michael Chong and his relatives, as persona non grata, and kick him out of the country. But the fact that this was required was absolutely shameful. But what was an important development following that is now there is a ministerial direction that all parliamentarians who are targeted, as Michael Chong was, must be informed. But it shouldn't have taken the loyal security service agent putting their livelihood, their careers on the line, although I would suggest it's not called Canada Secrets Act anymore, but essentially there's a public interest provision to it, but they risk a lot to do that. And there are questions that continue to exist around why has the Liberal government under Justin Trudeau been so slow, or even before that, so resistant to taking any real action, whether it is the Chinese police stations in Canada, because no arrests, to my knowledge, have occurred when it came to the Chinese police stations, which are illegal, which are extrajudicial. I mean, the the Chinese police have no jurisdiction in Canada. It's not Chinese soil. Why have there been no arrests? Why? Another thing that more recently has been probably one of the most alarming things for me, Simon, is we have a National Security and Intelligence Committee of parliamentarians. It is a multi-partisan committee, and they have studied a number of classified documents and other things, and ultimately they published a report, a secret report, that named 11 parliamentarians, Canadian MPs and senators. We still have an upper and a lower house. But they have named 11 Canadian parliamentarians who have betrayed Canada. They are traitors who have betrayed the country for personal and political gain. And all opposition parties have called for the government to release the names, and this government refuses to do so. There are also over 1,000 classified documents that both this committee as well as a commission of inquiry have requested. And again, the government refuses to release those documents. And everyone can't understand why. And the only rational, I think, question that everyone arrives to is, are they afraid that by releasing whether the 11 names or the 1,000 plus documents would incriminate them? Because what is the motivation for refusing to do so? Why do they continue to resist the need to shine that sunlight I was talking about into the shadows where these foreign operatives and their proxies, witting agents of foreign powers, like to hide?
It's extraordinary the similarities for what you're sharing. We have that lack of transparency as well. I might add our intelligence committee in Parliament, in my view, and actually a number of others, is very weak. It doesn't really have much power. So we don't have or haven't had the equivalent of that inquiry, but we've certainly seen, Kevin, a lack of transparency. In New Zealand's case, it's generally out of fear of China's trade retribution. Mm-hmm. But, you know, being blunt with you and to listeners, compromising our national security for a few dollars doesn't float my boat. You mentioned the police stations. We had two here. For listeners, look up something called Operation Fox Hunt. It's basically how the Chinese government pursues activists to draw them back, and they use these police stations. But what's been striking here is, as I and now other MPs had asked questions, it just went dark, as in New Zealand authorities just don't want to talk about it, which in itself is a concern. And then that, you know, third part you mentioned around the intelligence services saying nothing. That's what happened to me, a woman called Louisa Wall, an MP, and a professor, Anne-Marie Brady. Specifically targeted by the CCP, no one told us. It was the first of many attacks. They just didn't tell us. And it only, Kevin, when we got hold of classified FBI documents, legitimately, I might add, that we realized we and others actually in IPAC had been targeted, perhaps yourself as well. Mm-hmm. We took it to New Zealand's media 2 years later. And again, asking our intelligence agencies, why would you not tell us? Why would you not put sunlight? So, I mean, maybe we should switch then to those recommendations. I think you've given us two already. So you're talking about a foreign interference law updating that agent register. I think you'd mentioned a third recommendation. Well, what are some of the other things you would suggest to New Zealand that we should do in order to expose more the foreign interference happening on our own, you know, homelands?
Sure. So I've already talked about, I think, the need to introduce specific criminal offences to equip law enforcement with the toolkit around foreign interference, specific criminal offenses. I talked about the need for transparency, so creating a foreign agent registry. The third that I have is looking at the party system itself, and I recognize that there are some differences. You know, you have a proportional representation system. We still have first past the post, but there are loopholes in Canada around the political nomination process. And they're weakest, actually, within the governing party, within the Liberal Party, because through the commission inquiry into the issue of foreign interference, it became broad knowledge that if you want to be a candidate for the Liberal Party, and particularly in safe seats where it's not the general election that matters, you know, there are always certain kind of communities or electorates that always vote a particular way. So it's becoming the candidate for the party in that safe seat that actually matters more than general election. And so that was a weakness, particularly in the Liberal Party, where all you had to do was show up with documentation that alleged you lived there, and you didn't even have to be a citizen. So you had this weird situation where people who allegedly live in an electorate might not even be a citizen, might not even be able to vote legally in a general election, but then had a say in choosing the candidate for a particular party banner. And that is the case within the Liberal Party. It's ripe for abuse. And we heard of instances about how the Chinese would bus in busloads of students, Chinese students in particular, international students who had been threatened with having their student visa pulled. Even though the Chinese couldn't do that because those student visas are issued by Canada, but the reality is they can intimidate their families back home. And they also force some of these students to campaign and help their preferred candidate. And so the one thing, again, recognizing the differences in our systems and our electoral systems, but looking, really taking a critical eye at your political nomination process, I guess in New Zealand, that'd be your list process, and ensuring that you're closing any potential loopholes and any vulnerabilities for foreign actors.
Absolutely essential. I mean, I know our laws don't allow what you've just described for us here, although it doesn't allow for it, but there's a potential to game it if there's not enough oversight by the parties. But I have to say, from my own experience, it's not too bad. The issue we've got here is money. We've got a relatively transparent system there as well, but we've seen various organizations and community groups are able to funnel quite a lot of money into various political parties. And yep, it has to be declared. But we know that a number of community groups are just fronts for the United Front working group, which is, again, for listeners to understand, one of the arms of the Chinese Communist Party. But the same applies to other groups. Kevin, with a couple of minutes we've got left, and perhaps stepping back from foreign interference, we're both Commonwealth realms. We're part of Five Eyes. We have a lot of, commonalities. What do you see as sort of the future positives, if you will, for New Zealand and Canada? What are some of the things we can do and work together more closely with?
Canada needs help in the Indo-Pacific. And in my short time here, I've been able to meet with a number of New Zealand leaders. I met with some parliamentarians as well, too. And I think there's a real opportunity there for our countries to increase the things that we work on together. Obviously, New Zealand has long-standing historical relationship with Pacific Island nations who are very important. And I think Canada, being a bigger country, can help to scale up New Zealand's work within the Pacific, but also I think writ large when we look beyond just the Pacific and into the continent, right, of Asia. I think, you know, one thing that I always kind of got me excited was the idea of the Cairns-UK, you know, between Canada and New Zealand, UK and Australia, looking at how can we further integrate and strengthen our ties, given our shared Commonwealth heritage, given that, we're essentially four of the Five Eyes. I think there's ample opportunity to be able to build off of our shared heritage and our shared values. And I think there's untapped potential there.
Well, it's, one of the key things, of course, is that we share the Pacific. You might be miles away, but it actually is an area of common interest. to us. So if I could ask one last question, I mean, does New Zealand pop up, if you will, much? This is a very New Zealand question, you know, do you talk about us? But is you know, Canada, believe it or not, the UK, the United States, Australia is often in New Zealand discourse. Is it part of Canada's discourse? Do we get discussions around New Zealand and more cooperation within your parliament and media and elsewhere?
I don't think it gets in as much as it deserves. I can tell you during my time here, I've seen a lot of parallels, you know, just like how New Zealand is beside your big brother of Australia, Canada similarly is a case with the United States. That dynamic is something that I think binds us together, where Canada and New Zealand can learn from one another in how we deal with our big brothers, and also work together on, I think, shared issues of challenges like foreign interference, but also I think different opportunities around trade. I know I was looking actually at imports and exports between our two countries, and I think we're both very progressive countries, but we also have considerations around energy security, just security writ large. And like you say, we're both two Pacific nations. Despite being very far away, we're Pacific nations with a number of shared challenges, and we've spoken quite a bit about one of them, which is the Chinese Communist Party.
Well, Kevin, I'm incredibly grateful for your time, period, but also so generous with your time. Look, thank you for sharing all that you have, obviously, about Canada, your own experience, that of your wife and family as well. But welcome to New Zealand. I hope you enjoy your time here. Safe travels as you make your way back to Canada, and I look forward to perhaps chatting another time.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me, Simon.
Are you loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it, and right now they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.